insistent voice. "Where is Nomad? Where is Nomad? Where is Nomad? Where is Nomad? Where is Nomad?"
"Vorga," Voyle croaked. "Vorga."
He had been inoculated by his own fixation. His own nightmare had rendered him immune. "Where is Nomad? Where have you left Nomad? What happened to Nomad? Where is Nomad?"
"Vorga,"
Voyle shouted.
"Vorga, Vorga, Vorga."
In the control booth, Dagenham swore. The head of psychiatry, monitoring the projectors, glanced at the clock. 1 minute and 45 seconds, Sol. He can't stand much more.
He's got to break. Give him the final effect.
They buried Voyle alive, slowly, inexorably, hideously. He was carried down into black depths and enclosed in stinking slime that cut off light and air. He slowly suffocated, while a distant voice boomed,
"Where is Nomad? Where have you left Nomad? You can escape if you find Nomad. Where is Nomad?"
But Voyle was back aboard Nomad in his lightless, airless coffin, floating comfortably between deck and roof. He curled into a tight, fetal ball and prepared to sleep. He was content. He would escape. He would find Vorga.
"Impervious bastard," Dagenham swore. "Has anyone ever resisted Nightmare Theatre before, Fritz?"
"Not many. You're right. That's an uncommon man, Sol."
"He's got to be ripped open. All right, to hell with any more of this. We'll try the Megal mood next. Are the actors ready?"
"All ready."
"Then let's go."
There are 6 directions in which delusions of grandeur can run. The Megal, short for megalomania, mood, was therapy's dramatic diagnosis technique for establishing and plotting the particular course of megalomania. Voyle awoke in a luxurious 4-poster bed. He was in a bedroom hung with brocade, papered in velvet. He glanced around curiously. Soft sunlight filtered through latticed windows. Across the room, a valet was quietly laying out clothes.
"Hey,"
Voyle grunted. The valet turned. "Good morning, Mr. Fourmile," he murmured.
"What?"
"It's a lovely morning, sir. I've laid out the brown twill and the cordovan pump, sir."
"What's the matter, you?"
"I've..." The valet gazed at Voyle curiously. "Is anything wrong, Mr. Fourmile?"
"What do you call me, man?"
"By your name, sir."
"My name is... Fourmile?"
Voyle struggled up in the bed.
"No, it's not. It's Voyle, Gully Voyle. That's my name, me."
The valet bit his lip. "One moment, sir." He stepped outside and called. Then he murmured. A lovely girl in white came running into the bedroom and sat down on the edge of the bed. She took Foyle's hands and gazed into his eyes. Her face was distressed.
"Darling, darling, darling," she whispered. "You aren't going to start all that again, are you? The doctor swore you were over it."
"Start what again?"
"All that Gulliver Voyle nonsense about your being a common sailor and..."
"I am Gully Voyle. That's my name, Gully Voyle."
"Sweetheart, you're not. That's just a delusion you've had for weeks. You've been overworking and drinking too much."
"Been Gully Voyle all my life, me."
"Yes, I know, darling. That's the way it seemed to you. But you're not. You're Geoffrey Fourmile. The Geoffrey Fourmile. You're... Oh, what's the sense telling you? Get dressed, my love. You've got to come downstairs. Your office has been frantic."
Voyle permitted the valet to dress him and went downstairs in a daze. The lovely girl, who evidently adored him, conducted him through a giant studio littered with drawing tables, easels, and half-finished canvases. She took him to a vast hall filled with desks, filing cabinets, stock tickers, clerks, secretaries, office personnel. They entered a lofty laboratory, cluttered with glass and chrome. Burners flickered and hissed. bright-coloured liquids bubbled and churned. There was a pleasant odour of interesting chemicals and odd experiments.
"What's all this?" Foyle asked.
The girl seated Foyle in a plush armchair alongside a giant desk littered with interesting papers, scribbled with fascinating symbols. On some, Foyle saw the name Geoffrey Fourmile, scribbled in an imposing, authoritative signature.
"There's some crazy kind of mistake, is all," Foyle began.
The girl silenced him.
"Here's Dr. Regan. He'll explain."
An impressive gentleman with a crisp, comforting manner came to Foyle, touched his pulse, inspected his eyes, and nodded in satisfaction.
"Good," he said. "Excellent. You are close to complete recovery, Mr. Fourmile. Now will you listen to me for a moment,
Foyle nodded.
"You remember nothing of the past. You have only a false memory. You were overworked. You are an important man, and there were too many demands on you. You started to drink heavily a month ago. No, no, denial is useless. You drank. You lost yourself. You became convinced you were not the famous Jeff Fourmile, an infantile attempt to escape responsibility. You imagined you were a common spaceman named Foyle. Gulliver Foyle, yes? With an odd number.
Golly Foyle. AS-128/127:006. But that's me.
It is not you. This is you."
Dr. Regan waved at the interesting offices they could see through the transparent glass wall.
"You can only recapture the true memory if you discharge the old. All this glorious reality is yours, if we can help you discard the dream of the spaceman."
Dr. Regan leaned forward, his polished spectacles glittering hypnotically.
"Reconstruct this false memory of yours in detail, and I will tear it down. Where do you imagine you left the spaceship Nomad? How did you escape? Where do you imagine the Nomad is now?"
Foyle wavered before the romantic glamour of the scene which seemed to be just within his grasp.
"It seems to me I left Nomad out in..."
He stopped short. A devil face peered at him from the highlights reflected in Dr. Regan's spectacles, a hideous tiger mask with Nomad blazoned across the distorted brow. Foyle stood up.
"Liars," he growled. "It's real, me. This here is phony. What happened to me is real. I'm real, me."
Saul Dagenham walked into the laboratory.
"All right," he called. "Strike. It's a washout."
The bustling scene in laboratory, office, and studio ended. The actors quietly disappeared without another glance at Foyle. Dagenham gave Foyle his deadly smile.
"Tough, aren't you? You're really unique. My name is Saul Dagenham. We've got 5 minutes for a talk. Come into the garden."
The sedative garden atop the therapy building was a triumph of therapeutic planning. Every perspective, every colour, every contour had been designed to placate hostility, soothe resistance, melt anger, evaporate hysteria, absorb melancholia and depression.
"Sit down," Dagenham said,
pointing to a bench alongside a pool in which crystal waters tinkled.
"Don't try to jaunt. You're drugged. I'll have to walk around a bit. Can't come close to you. I'm hot. Do you know what that means?"
Foyle shook his head sullenly. Dagenham cupped both hands around the flaming blossom of an orchid and held them there for a moment.
"Watch that flower," he said. "You'll see."
He paced up a path and turned suddenly.
"You're right, of course. Everything that happened to you is real."
"Only what did happen?"
"Go to hell," Foyle growled.
"You know, Foyle, I admire you."
"Go to hell."
"In your own primitive way, you've got ingenuity and guts. You're Cro-Magnon, Foyle. I've been checking on you. That bomb you threw in the Prestane shipyards was lovely, and you nearly wrecked General Hospital getting the money and material together."
Dagenham counted fingers.
"You looted lockers, stole from the blind ward, stole drugs from the pharmacy, stole apparatus from the lab stockrooms."
"Go to hell, you!" But what have you got against Prestane? Why'd you try to blow up his shipyard? They tell me you broke in and went tearing through the pits like a wild man. What were you trying to do, Foyle?
Go to hell.
Dagenham smiled. If we're going to chat, he said, you'll have to hold up your end. Your conversation's getting monotonous.
What happened to Nomad?
I don't know about Nomad. Nothing.
The ship was last reported over 7 months ago. Then, spurlos versenkt. Are you the sole survivor? And what have you been doing all this time? Having your face decorated?
I don't know about Nomad. Nothing.
No, no, Foyle, that won't do. You show up with Nomad tattooed across your face, fresh tattooed. Intelligence checks and finds you were aboard Nomad when she sailed.
Foyle Gulliver, AS-128/127:006, Mechanics Mate 3rd Class.
As if this isn't enough to throw intelligence into a tizzy, you come back in a private launch that's been missing 50 years. Man, you're cooking in the reactor.
Intelligence wants answers to all these questions. And you ought to know how Central Intelligence butchers its answers out of people.
Foyle started. Dagenham nodded as he saw his point sink home.
Which is why I think you'll listen to reason. We want information, Foyle.
I tried to trick it out of you, admitted. I failed because you're too tough, admitted. Now I'm offering an honest deal. We'll protect you if you'll cooperate. If you don't, you'll spend 5 years in an intelligence lab, having information chopped out of you.
It was not the prospect of the butchery that frightened Foyle, but the thought of the loss of freedom. A man had to be free to avenge himself, to raise money and find Vorga again, to rip and tear and gut Vorga.
What kind of deal?
He asked.
Tell us what happened to Nomad and where you left her.
Why, man?
Why? Because of the salvage, man.
There ain't nothing to salvage. She's a wreck is all.
Even a wreck's salvageable.
You mean you'd jet out 1,000,000 miles to pick up pieces? Don't joke on me, man.
All right,
Dagenham said in exasperation.
There's the cargo.
She was split wide open. No cargo left.
It was the cargo you didn't know about, Dagenham said confidentially. Nomad was transporting platinum bullion to Mars Bank. Every so often, banks have to adjust accounts. Normally enough trade goes on between planets so that accounts can be balanced on paper. The wars disrupted normal trade, and Mars Bank found that Prestane owed them 20-odd million credits, without any way of getting the money short of actual delivery. Prestane was delivering the money in bar platinum aboard the Nomad. It was locked in the purser's safe.
20 million,
Foyle whispered.
Give or take a few thousand. The ship was insured, but that just means that the underwriters, Bonus and Uick, get the salvage rights, and they're even tougher than Prestane. However, there'll be a reward for you, say 20,000 credits.
20 million,
Foyle whispered again.
We're assuming that an OS raider caught up with Nomad somewhere on course and let her have it. They couldn't have boarded and looted, or you wouldn't have been left alive. This means that the purser's safe is still...
Are you listening, Foyle?
But Foyle was not listening. He was seeing 20 million, not 20,000, 20 million in platinum bullion as a broad highway to Vorga.
No more petty thefts from lockers and labs. 20 million for the taking and the raising of Vorga.
Foyle?
Foyle awoke. He looked at Dagenham.
I don't know about Nomad. Nothing, he said.
What the hell's got into you now? Why are you dummying up again?
I don't know about Nomad. Nothing.
I'm offering a fair reward. A spaceman could go on a hell of a tear with 20,000 credits, a 1-year tear. What more do you want?
I don't know about Nomad. Nothing.
It's us or intelligence, Foyle.
You ain't so anxious for them to get me, or you wouldn't be flipping through all this. But it ain't no use anyway. I don't know about Nomad. Nothing.
You son of a...
Dagenham tried to repress his anger. He'd revealed just a little too much to this cunning, primitive creature.
You're right, he said. We're not anxious for intelligence to get you, but we've made our own preparations.
His voice hardened.
You think you can dummy up and stand us off? You think you can leave us to whistle for Nomad? You've even got an idea that you can beat us to the salvage.
No,
Foyle said.
Now listen to this. We've got a lawyer waiting in New York. He's got a criminal prosecution for piracy pending against you. Piracy in space, murder and looting. We're going to throw the book at you. Prestaine will get a conviction in 24 hours. If you've got a criminal record of any kind, that means a lobotomy. They'll open up the top of your skull and burn out half your brain to stop you from ever jaunting again.
Dagenham stopped and looked hard at Foyle. When Foyle shook his head, Dagenham continued,
If you haven't got a record, they'll hand you 10 years of what is laughingly known as medical treatment. We don't punish criminals in our enlightened age, we cure them. And the cure is worse than punishment. They'll stash you in a black hole in one of the cave hospitals. You'll be kept in permanent darkness and solitary confinement, so you can't jaunt out. They'll go through the motions of giving you shots and therapy, but you'll be rotting in the dark. You'll stay there and rot until you decide to talk. We'll keep you there forever. So make up your mind.
I don't know nothing about Nomad. Nothing,
Foyle said.
All right, Dagenham spat.
Suddenly he pointed to the orchid blossom he had enclosed with his hands. It was blighted and rotting.
That's what's going to happen to you.
Chapter 5. South of Saint-Girons, near the Spanish-French border, is the deepest abyss in France, the Gouffre Martel. Its caverns twist for miles under the Pyrenees. It is the most formidable cavern hospital on Terra. No patient has ever jaunted out of its pitch darkness. No patient has ever succeeded in getting his bearings and learning the jaunt coordinates of the black hospital depths. Short of prefrontal lobotomy, there are only three ways to stop a man from jaunting. A blow on the head producing concussion, sedation, which prevents concentration, and concealment of jaunt coordinates. Of the three, the jaunting age considered concealment the most practical. The cells that line the winding passages of Gouffre Martel are cut out of living rock. They are never illuminated. The passages are never illuminated. Infrared lamps flood the darkness. It is black light, visible only to guards and attendants wearing snooper goggles with specially treated lenses. For the patients, there is only the black silence of Gouffre Martel, broken by the distant rush of underground waters. For Foyle, there was only the silence, the rushing, and the hospital routine. At 8 o'clock, or it may have been any hour in this timeless abyss, he was awakened by a bell. He arose and received his morning meal, slotted into the cell by pneumatic tube. It had to be eaten at once, for the china surrogate of cups and plates was timed to dissolve in 15 minutes. At 8:30 the cell door opened, and Foyle and hundreds of others shuffled blindly through the twisting corridors to sanitation. Here, still in darkness, they were processed like beef in a slaughterhouse, cleansed, shaved, irradiated, disinfected, dosed and inoculated. Their paper uniforms were removed and sent back to the shops to be pulped. New uniforms were issued. Then they shuffled back to their cells, which had been automatically scrubbed out while they were in sanitation. In his cell, Foyle listened to interminable therapeutic talks, lectures, moral and ethical guidance for the rest of the morning. Then there was silence again, and nothing but the rush of distant water and the quiet steps of goggled guards in the corridors. In the afternoon came occupational therapy. The TV screen in each cell illuminated, and the patient thrust his hands into the shadow frame of the screen. He saw three-dimensionally, and he felt the broadcast objects and tools. He cut hospital uniforms, sewed them, manufactured kitchen utensils, and prepared foods. Although actually he touched nothing, his motions were transmitted to the shops where the work was accomplished by remote control. After one short hour of this relief came the darkness and silence again. But every so often, once or twice a week, or perhaps once or twice a year, came the muffled thud of a distant explosion. The concussions were startling enough to distract Foyle from the furnace of vengeance that he stoked all through the silences. He whispered quietly to the invisible figures around him in sanitation.
"What's them explosions?" "Explosions? Blow-ups. Hear 'em a long way off me. Them's blue jaunts." "What?" "Blue jaunts. Every time a guy gets fed up with old Jeffrey, can't take it no more, him. Jaunts into the wild blue yonder." "Jesus." "Yep. Don't know where they are, them. Don't know where they're going. Blue jaunt into the dark, and we hear 'em exploding in the mountains. Boom. Blue jaunt." He was appalled, but he could understand.
The darkness, the silence, the monotony destroyed sense and brought on desperation. The loneliness was intolerable. The patients buried in Gouffre Martel prison hospital looked forward eagerly to the morning sanitation period for a chance to whisper a word and hear a word. But these fragments were not enough, and desperation came. Then there would be another distant explosion. Sometimes the suffering men would turn on each other, and then a savage fight would break out in sanitation. These were instantly broken up by the goggled guards, and the morning lecture would switch on the moral fibre record, preaching the virtue of patience. Foyle learned the records by heart, every word, every click and crack in the tapes. He learned to loathe the voices of the lecturers, the understanding baritone, the cheerful tenor, the man-to-man bass. He learned to deafen himself to the therapeutic monotony and perform his occupational therapy mechanically. But he was without resources to withstand the endless solitary hours. Fury was not enough. He had lost count of the days, of meals, of sermons. He no longer whispered in sanitation. His mind came adrift, and he began to wander. He imagined he was back aboard Nomad, reliving his fight for survival. Then he lost even his feeble grasp on illusion, and began to sink deeper and deeper into the pit of catatonia, of womb silence, womb darkness, and womb sleep. There were fleeting dreams. An angel hummed to him once. Another time she sang quietly. Thrice he heard her speak, "Oh, God!" and "God damn!" and "Oh!" in a heart-rending descending note. He sank into his abyss, listening to her.
"There is a way out,"
his angel murmured in his ear, sweetly, comforting. Her voice was soft and warm, yet it burned with anger. It was the voice of a furious angel.
"There is a way out."
It whispered in his ear from nowhere, and suddenly, with the logic of desperation, it came to him that there was a way out of Gouffre Martel. He had been a fool not to see it before.
"Yes," he croaked, "there is a way out."
There was a soft gasp, then a soft question.
"Who's there?"
"Me is all," Foyle said. "You know me."
"Where are you?"
"Here, where I always been me."
"But there's no one. I'm alone."
"Gotta thank you for helping me."
"Hearing voices is bad,"
the furious angel murmured.
"The first step off the deep end. I've gotta stop."
"You showed me the way out. Blue jaunt."
"Blue jaunt? My God, this must be real. You're talking the gutter lingo. You must be real. Who are you?"
"Gully Foyle."
"But you're not in my cell. You're not even near. Men are in the north quadrant of Gouffre Martel. Women are in the south. I'm south 900. Where are you?"
"North 111.
"You're a quarter of a mile away. How can we... Of course. It's the whisper line. I always thought that was a legend, but it's true. It's working now.
Here I go, me, Foyle whispered. Blue jaunt.
Foyle, listen to me. Forget the blue jaunt. Don't throw this away. It's a miracle.
What's a miracle?
There's an acoustical freak in Gouffre Martel. They happen in underground caves. A freak of echoes, passages and whispering galleries. Old-timers call it the whisper line. I never believed them. No one ever did, but it's true. We're talking to each other over the whisper line. No one can hear us but us. We can talk, Foyle. We can plan. Maybe we can escape.
Her name was Gisbella McQueen. She was hot-tempered, independent, intelligent, and she was serving 5 years of cure in Gouffre Martel for larceny. Gisbella gave Foyle a cheerfully furious account of her revolt against society.
You don't know what jaunting's done to women, Gully. It's locked us up, sent us back to the Seraglio.
What Seraglio, girl?
A harem, a place where women are kept on ice. After 1,000 years of civilization, it says here, we're still property. Jaunting's such a danger to our virtue, our value, our mint condition, that we're locked up like gold plate in a safe. There's nothing for us to do, nothing respectable. No jobs, no careers. There's no getting out, Gully, unless you bust out and smash all the rules.
Did you have to jizz?
I had to be independent, Gully. I had to live my own life. And that's the only way society would let me. So I ran away from home and turned crook.
And Jizz went on to describe the lurid details of her revolt, the temper racket, the cataract racket, the honeymoon and obituary robs, the badger jaunt, and the glim drop. Foyle told her about Nomad and Vorga, his hatred and his plans. He did not tell Gisbella about his face, or the 20 millions in platinum bullion waiting out in the asteroids.
What happened to Nomad? Gisbella asked. Was it like that man Dagenham said? Was she blasted by an OS raider?
I don't know, me. Can't remember, girl.
The blast probably wiped out your memory. Shock and being marooned for 6 months didn't help. Did you notice anything worth salvaging from Nomad?
No.
Did Dagenham mention anything?
No.
Foyle lied.
Then he must have another reason for hounding you into Gouffre Martel. There must be something else he wants from Nomad.
Yeah, Jizz.
But you were a fool trying to blow up Vorga like that. You're like a wild beast trying to punish the trap that injured it. Steel isn't alive. It doesn't think. You can't punish Vorga.
Don't know what you mean, girl. Vorga passed me by.
You punish the brain, Gully. The brain that sets the trap. Find out who was aboard Vorga. Find out who gave the order to pass you by. Punish him.
Yeah. How?
Learn to think, Gully. The head that could figure out how to get Nomad underway and how to put a bomb together ought to be able to figure that out. But no more bombs. Brains instead. Locate a member of Vorga's crew. He'll tell you who was aboard. Track them down. Find out who gave the order. Then punish him. But it'll take time, Gully. Time and money. More than you've got.
I got a whole life, me.
They murmured for hours across the whisper line, their voices sounding small, yet close to the ear. There was only one particular spot in each cell where the other could be heard, which was why so much time had passed before they discovered the miracle. But now they made up for lost time, and Gisbella educated Foyle.
If we ever break out of Gouffre Martel, Gully, it'll have to be together, and I'm not trusting myself to an illiterate partner.
Who's illiterate?
You are, Gisbella answered firmly. I have to talk gutter-a-you half the time, me.
I can read and write.
And that's about all. Which means outside of brute strength you'll be useless.
Talk sense, you, he said angrily.
I am talking sense, me. What's the use of the strongest chisel in the world if it doesn't have an edge? We've got to sharpen your wits, Gully. Got to educate you, man, is all.
He submitted. He realized she was right. He would need training not only for the bust-out, but for the search for Vorga as well. Gisbella was the daughter of an architect and had received an education. This she drilled into Foyle, leavened with the cynical experience of 5 years in the underworld. Occasionally he rebelled against the hard work, and then there would be whispered quarrels. But in the end he would apologize and submit again. And sometimes Gisbella would tire of teaching, and they would ramble on, sharing dreams in the dark.
"I think we're falling in love, Gully."
"I think so too, Gis."
"I'm an old hag, Gully. 105 years old. What are you like?"
"Awful."
"How awful?"
"My face."
"You make yourself sound romantic. Is it one of those exciting scars that make a man attractive?"
"No. You'll see when we meet, us." "That's wrong, isn't it, Gis? Just plain, when we meet, period."
"Good boy."
"We will meet some day, won't we, Gis?"
"Soon, I hope, Gully."
Gisbella's faraway voice became crisp and businesslike.
"But we've got to stop hoping and get down to work. We've got to plan and prepare."
From the underworld, Gisbella had inherited a mass of information about Gufra Martell. No one had ever jaunted out of the cavern hospitals, but for decades the underworld had been collecting and collating information about them. It was from this data that Gisbella had formed her quick recognition of the whisper line that joined them. It was on the basis of this information that she began to discuss escape.
"We can pull it off, Gully. Never doubt that for a minute. There must be dozens of loopholes in their security system."
"No one's ever found them before."
"No one's ever worked with a partner before. We'll pool our information, and we'll make it."
He no longer shambled to sanitation and back. He felt the corridor walls, noted doors, noted their texture, counted, listened, deduced, and reported. He made a note of every separate step in the sanitation pens and reported them to Gis. The questions he whispered to the men around him in the shower and scrub rooms had purpose. Together, Foyle and Gisbella built a picture of the routine of Gufra Martell and its security system. One morning, on the return from sanitation, he was stopped as he was about to step back into his cell.
"Stay in line, Foyle."
"This is North 111. I know where to get off by now. Keep moving."
"But..."
He was terrified.
"You're changing me?"
"Visitor to see you."
He was marched up to the end of the north corridor, where it met the three other main corridors that formed the huge cross of the hospital. In the centre of the cross were the administration offices, maintenance workshops, clinics and plants. Foyle was thrust into a room as dark as his cell. The door was shut behind him. He became aware of a faint, shimmering outline in the blackness. It was no more than the ghost of an image, with a blurred body and a death's head. Two black discs on the skull face were either eye sockets or infrared goggles.
"Good morning," said Saul Dagenham. "You?"
Foyle exclaimed.
"Me. I've got 5 minutes. Sit down. Chair behind you."
Foyle felt for the chair and sat down slowly.
"Enjoying yourself?"
Dagenham inquired.
"What do you want, Dagenham?"
"There's been a change," Dagenham said dryly. "Last time we talked, your dialogue consisted entirely of go to hell."
"Go to hell, Dagenham, if it'll make you feel any better."
"Your repartee's improved. Your speech, too."
"You've changed," Dagenham said.
"Changed a damn sight too much and a damn sight too fast."
"I don't like it. What's happened to you?"
"I've been going to night school."
"You've had 10 months in this night school."
10 months?
Foyle echoed in amazement.
"That long?"
10 months, without sight and without sound. 10 months in solitary. You ought to be broke."
"Oh, I'm broke, all right."
"You ought to be whining."
"I was right. You're unusual."
"At this rate, it's going to take too long. We can't wait. I'd like to make a new offer."
"Make it."
10% of Nomad's bullion. 2 million.
2 million?
Foyle exclaimed.
"Why didn't you offer that in the first place?"
"Because I didn't know your caliber."
Is it a deal?
Almost. Not yet.
What else?
I get out of Gouffre Martel.
Naturally.
And someone else, too.
It can be arranged.
Dagenham's voice sharpened.
Anything else?
I get access to Prestane's files. Out of the question. Are you insane? Be reasonable.
His shipping files.
What for?
A list of personnel aboard one of his ships.
Oh.
Dagenham's eagerness revived. That I can arrange.
Anything else?
No.
Then it's a deal.
Dagenham was delighted. The ghostly blur of light arose from its chair.
We'll have you out in 6 hours. We'll start arrangements for your friend at once. It's a pity we wasted this time, but no one can figure you, Foyle.
Why didn't you send in a telepath to work me over?
A telepath? Be reasonable, Foyle. There aren't 10 full telepaths in all the inner planets. Their time is earmarked for the next 10 years.
We couldn't persuade one to interrupt his schedule for love or money.
I apologize, Dagenham. I thought you didn't know your business.
You very nearly hurt my feelings.
Now I know you're just lying.
You're flattering me.
You could have hired a telepath. For a cut in 20 million, you could have hired one easy.
The government would never...
They don't all work for the government.
No, you've got something too hot to let a telepath get near.
A blur of light leaped across the room and seized Foyle.
How much do you know, Foyle? What are you covering? Who are you working for?
Dagenham's hand shook.
Christ, what a fool I've been. Of course you're unusual. You're no common spaceman. I asked you, who are you working for?
Foyle tore Dagenham's hands away from him.
No one, he said. No one, except myself.
No one, eh? Including your friend in Gouffre Martel you're so eager to rescue?
By God, you almost swindled me, Foyle.
Tell Captain Yang Yeovil I congratulate him. He's got a better staff than I thought.
I never heard of any Yang Yeovil.
You and your colleague are going to rot in here. It's no deal. You're fester here. I'll have you moved to the worst cell in the hospital. I'll sink you to the bottom of Gouffre Martel. I'll... Guard, here! Good.
Foyle grasped Dagenham's throat, dragged him down to the floor, and hammered his head on the flagstones. Dagenham squirmed once, and then was still. Foyle ripped the goggles off his face and put them on. Sight returned, in soft red and rose lights and shadows. He was in a small reception room, with a table and 2 chairs. Foyle stripped Dagenham's jacket off and put it on with 2 quick jerks that split the shoulders. Dagenham's cocked highwayman's hat lay on the table. Foyle clapped it over his head and pulled the brim down before his face. On opposite walls were 2 doors. Foyle opened one a crack. It led out to the north corridor. He closed it, leaped across the room and tried the other. It opened into a jaunt-proof maze. Foyle slipped through the door and entered the maze. Without a guide to lead him through the labyrinth, he was immediately lost. He began to run around the twists and turns and found himself back at the reception room. Dagenham was struggling to his knees. Foyle turned back into the maze again. He ran. He came to a closed door and thrust it open. It revealed a large workshop, illuminated by normal light. 2 technicians, working at a machine bench, looked up in surprise. Foyle snatched up a sledgehammer, leaped on them like a caveman, and felled them. Behind him, he heard Dagenham shouting in the distance. He looked around wildly, dreading the discovery that he was trapped in a cul-de-sac. The workshop was L-shaped. Foyle tore around the corner, burst through the entrance of another jaunt-proof maze, and was lost again. The Gouffre Martel alarm system began clattering. Foyle battered at the walls of the labyrinth with the sledge, shattering the thin plastic masking, and found himself in the infrared-lit south corridor of the women's quadrant. 2 women guards came up the corridor, running hard. Foyle swung the sledge and dropped them. He was near the head of the corridor. Before him stretched a long perspective of cell doors, each bearing a glowing red number. Overhead, the corridor was lit by glowing red globes. Paul stood on tiptoe and clubbed the globe above him. He hammered through the socket and smashed the current cable. The entire corridor went dark, even to goggles.
"Evens us up. All in the dark now,"
Foyle gasped, and tore down the corridor, feeling the wall as he ran, and counting cell doors. Gisbella had given him an accurate word picture of the South Quadrant. He was counting his way towards South 900. He blundered into a figure, another guard. Foyle hacked at her once with his sledge. She shrieked and fell. The women patients began shrieking. Foyle lost count, ran on, stopped.
"Jizz!"
he bellowed. He heard her voice. He encountered another guard, disposed of her, ran, located Gisbella's cell.
"Golly, for God's sake!"
Her voice was muffled.
"Get back, girl, back!"
He hammered thrice against the door with his sledge, and it burst inward. He staggered in and fell against a figure.
"Jizz!" he gasped. "Excuse me. Was passing by. Thought I'd drop in."
"Golly, in the name of—"
"Yeah, hell of a way to meet, huh? Come on, out, girl, out!"
He dragged her out of the cell.
"We can't try a break through the offices. They don't like me back there. Which way do your sanitation pens?"
"Golly, you're crazy."
"All quadrants dark. I smashed the power cable. We've got half a chance. Go, girl, go!"
He gave her a powerful thrust, and she led him down the passages to the automatic stalls of the women's sanitation pens. While mechanical hands removed their uniforms, soaped, soaked, sprayed and disinfected them, Foyle felt for the glass pane of the medical observation window. He found it, swung the sledge, and smashed it.
"Get in, Jizz!"
He hurled her through the window and followed. They were both stripped, greasy with soap, slashed and bleeding. Foyle slipped and crashed through the blackness, searching for the door through which the medical officers entered.
"Can't find the door, Jizz. Door from the clinic. I—" "Shh! But be quiet, Gully!"
A soapy hand found his mouth and clamped over it. She gripped his shoulder so hard that her fingernails pierced his skin. Through the bedlam in the caverns sounded the clatter of steps close at hand. Guards were running blindly through the sanitation stalls. The infrared lights had not yet been repaired.
"They may not notice the window,"
Gisbella hissed.
"Be quiet."
They crouched on the floor. Steps trampled through the pens in bewildering succession. Then they were gone.
"All clear now,"
Gisbella whispered.
"But they'll have searchlights any minute. Come on, Gully, out."
"But the door to the clinic, Jess. I thought—"
"There is no door. They use spiral stairs and they pull them up. They've thought of this escape, too. We'll have to try the laundry lift. God knows what good it'll do us. Oh, Gully, you fool! You utter fool!"
They climbed through the observation window back into the pens. They searched through the darkness for the lifts by which soiled uniforms were removed and fresh uniforms issued. And in the darkness, the automatic hands again soaped, sprayed and disinfected them. They could find nothing. The caterwauling of a siren suddenly echoed through the caverns, silencing all other sound. There came a hush as suffocating as the darkness.
"They're using the geophone to track us, Gully."
"The what?"
"Geophone. It can trace a whisper through half a mile of solid rock. That's why they've sirened for silence."
"The laundry lift?"
"Can't find it."
"Then come on."
"Where?"
"We're running."
"Where?"
"I don't know, but I'm not getting caught flat-footed. Come on, the exercise'll do you good."
Again he thrust Gisbella before him, and they ran, gasping and stumbling, through the blackness, down into the deepest reaches of Southern Quadrant. Gisbella fell twice, blundering against turns in the passages. Foyle took the lead and ran, holding the 20-pound sledge in his hand, the handle extended before him as an antenna. Then they crashed into a blank wall and realized they had reached the dead end of the corridor. They were boxed, trapped.
"What now?"
"Don't know. Looks like the dead end of my ideas, too. We can't go back for sure. A club of Dagenham in the offices. Hate that man. Looks like a poison label. You got a flash, girl?
Oh, golly, golly.
Gisbella sobbed.
Was counting on you for ideas. No more bombs, you said. Wish I had one now. Could...
Wait a minute. He touched the oozing wall against which they were leaning. He felt the checkerboard indentations of mortar seams.
Bulletin from G-Foil. This isn't a natural cave wall. It's made. Brick and stone. Feel.
Gisbella felt the wall.
So?
Means this passage doesn't end here. Goes on. They blocked it off. Out of the way.
He shoved Gisbella up the passage, ground his hands into the floor to grit his soapy palms, and began swinging the sledge against the wall. He swung in steady rhythm, grunting and gasping. The steel sledge struck the wall with the blunt concussions of stone struck under water.
"They're coming," Jis said. "I hear them."
The blunt blows took on a crumbling, crushing overtone. There was a whisper, then a steady pebble fall of loose mortar. Foyle redoubled his efforts. Suddenly there was a crash, and a gush of icy air blew in their faces.
"Through,"
Foyle muttered. He attacked the edges of the hole pierced through the wall with ferocity. Bricks, stones, and old mortar flew. Foyle stopped and called Gisbella.
"Try it."
He dropped the sledge, seized her, and held her up to the chest-high opening. She cried out in pain as she tried to wriggle past the sharp edges. Foyle pressed her relentlessly until she got her shoulders and then her hips through. He let go of her legs and heard her fall on the other side. Foyle pulled himself up and tore himself through the jagged breach in the wall. He felt Gisbella's hands trying to break his fall as he crashed down in a mass of loose brick and mortar. They were both through into the icy blackness of the unoccupied caverns of Gouffre Martel, miles of unexplored grottos and caves.
"By God, we'll make it yet,"
Foyle mumbled.
"I don't know if there's a way out, Gully."
Gisbella was shaking with cold.
"Maybe this is all cul-de-sac, walled off from the hospital."
"There has to be a way out."
"I don't know if we can find it."
"We've got to find it. Let's go, girl."
They blundered forward in the darkness. Foyle tore the useless set of goggles from his eyes. They crashed against ledges, corners, low ceilings. They fell down slopes and steep steps. They climbed over a razorback ridge to a level plain, and their feet shot from under them. Both fell heavily to a glassy floor. Foyle felt and touched it with his tongue.
"Ice," he muttered. "Good sign. We're in an ice cavern, Jis. Underground glacier."
They arose shakily, straddling their legs, and worked their way across the ice that had been forming in the Gouffre Martel abyss for millennia. They climbed into a forest of stone saplings that were stalagmites and stalactites, thrusting up from the jagged floor and down from the ceilings. The vibrations of every step loosened the huge stalactites, ponderous stone spears that thundered down from overhead. At the edge of the forest, Foyle stopped, reached out, and tugged. There was a clear metallic ring. He took Gisbella's hand and placed the long, tapering cone of a stalagmite in it.
"Cain," he grunted, "use it like a blind man."
He broke off another, and they went tapping, feeling, stumbling through the darkness. There was no sound but the gallop of panic, their gasping breath and racing hearts, the taps of their stone canes, the multitudinous drip of water, the distant rushing of the underground river beneath Gouffre Martel.
"Not that way, girl,"
Foyle nudged her shoulder.
"More to the left."
"Have you the faintest notion where we're headed, Gully?"
"Down, Jis. Follow any slope that leads down."
"You've got an idea?"
"Yeah. Surprise, surprise. Brains instead of bombs."
"Brains instead of..."
Gisbella shrieked with hysterical laughter.
"You exploded into South Quadrant with a sledgehammer, and that's your idea of brains instead of..."
She brayed and hooted beyond all control until Foyle grasped her and shook her.
"Shut up, Jis. If they're tracking us by G-phone, they could hear you from Mars."
"Sorry, Gully. Sorry,
She took a breath.
"Why down?"
"The The river, the one we hear all the time, it must be near. It probably melts out the glacier back there.
The river?
The only sure way out. It must break out of the mountain somewhere. We'll swim.
Golly, you're insane.
What's the matter, you? You can't swim?
I can swim, but...
Then we gotta try. Got to, Jiz. Come on.
The rush of the river grew louder as their strength began to fail. Gisbella pulled to a halt at last, gasping.
Golly, I've got to rest.
Too cold. Keep moving.
I can't.
Keep moving.
He felt for her arm.
Get your hands off me,
she cried furiously. In an instant she was all spitfire. He released her in amazement.
What's the matter with you? Keep your head, Jiz. I'm depending on you.
For what? I told you we had to plan, work out an escape, and now you've trapped us into this.
I was trapped myself. Dagenham was going to change my cell. No more whisper line for us. I had to, Jiz. And we're out, aren't we?
Out where? Lost in Gouffre Martel, looking for a damned river to drown in. You're a fool, Gully, and I'm an idiot for letting you trap me into this. Damn you! Damn you! You pull everything down to your imbecile level, and you pulled me down too. Run, fight, punch, that's all you know. Beat, break, blast, destroy. Gully!
Gisbella screamed. There was a clatter of loose stone in the darkness, and her scream faded down and away to a heavy splash. Foyle heard the thrash of her body in water. He leaped forward, shouted, "Jiz!" and staggered over the edge of a precipice. He fell and struck the water flat with a stunning impact. The icy river enclosed him, and he could not tell where the surface was. He struggled, suffocated, felt the swift current drag him against the chill slime of rocks, and then was borne bubbling to the surface. He coughed and shouted. He heard Gisbella answer, her voice faint and muffled by the roaring torrent. He swam with the current, trying to overtake her. He shouted, and heard her answering voice growing fainter and fainter. The roaring grew louder, and abruptly he was shot down the hissing sheet of a waterfall. He plunged to the bottom of a deep pool and struggled once more to the surface. The whirling current entangled him with a cold body, bracing itself against a smooth rock wall.
"Jiz!"
"Golly, thank God!"
They clung together for a moment while the water tore at them.
"Golly!"
Gisbella coughed.
"It goes through here."
"The river?"
"Yes."
He squirmed past her, bracing himself against the wall, and felt the mouth of an underwater tunnel. The current was sucking them into it.
"Hold on,"
Foyle gasped. He explored to the left and the right. The walls of the pool were smooth, without handhold.
"We can't climb out. Have to go through."
"There's no air, Gully. No surface."
"Couldn't be forever. We'll hold our breath."
"It could be longer than we can hold our breath."
"Have to gamble."
"I can't do it."
"You must. No other way. Pump your lungs. Hold on to me."
They supported each other in the water, gasping for breath, filling their lungs. Foyle nudged Gisbella toward the underwater tunnel.
"You go first. I'll be right behind. Help you if you get into trouble."
"Trouble?"
Gisbella cried in a shaking voice. She submerged and permitted the current to suck her into the tunnel mouth. Foyle followed. The fierce waters drew them down, 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 caroming from side to side of a tunnel that had been worn glass smooth. Foyle swam close behind Gisbella, feeling her thrashing legs beat his head and shoulders. They shot through the tunnel until their lungs burst and their blind eyes started. Then there was a roaring again, and a surface, and they could breathe. The glassy tunnel sides were replaced by jagged rocks. Foyle caught Gisbella's leg and seized a stone projection at the side of the river.
"Gotta climb out here," he shouted.
"What?"
"Gotta climb out. You hear that roaring up ahead? Cataracts, rapids, be torn to pieces. Out, Jiz."
She was too weak to climb out of the water. He thrust her body up onto the rocks and followed. They lay on the dripping stones, too exhausted to speak. At last, Foyle got wearily to his feet.
"Have to keep on," he said. "Follow the river. Ready?"
She could not answer. She could not protest. He pulled her up, and they went stumbling through the darkness, trying to follow the bank of the torrent. The boulders they traversed were gigantic, standing like dolmens, heaped, jumbled, scattered into a labyrinth. They staggered and twisted through them, and lost the river. They could hear it in the darkness. They could not get back to it. They could get nowhere.
"Lost," Foyle grunted in disgust. "We're lost again. Really lost this time. What are we going to do?"
Gisbella began to cry. She made helpless yet furious sounds. Foyle lurched to a stop and sat down, drawing her down with him.
"Maybe you're right, girl," he said wearily. "Maybe I am a damn fool. I got us trapped into this no-jaunt jam and we're licked."
She didn't answer.
"So much for brainwork. Hell of an education you gave me."
He hesitated.
"You think we ought to try backtracking to the hospital?"
"We'll never make it."
"Guess not. We're just practicing my brain. Should we start a racket? Make a noise so they can track us by G-phone?"
"They'd never hear us. Never find us in time."
"We could make enough noise. You could knock me around a little. Be a pleasure for both of us."
"Shut up."
"What a mess."
He sagged back, cushioning his head on a tuft of soft grass.
"At least I had a chance aboard Nomad. There was food, and I could see where I was trying to go. I could..."
He broke off and sat bolt upright.
"Jizz!
Don't talk so much." He felt the ground under him and clawed up sods of earth and tufts of grass. He thrust them into her face.
"Smell this," he laughed. "Taste it. It's grass, Jizz. Earth and grass. We must be out of Gouffre Martel."
"What?"
"It's night outside, pitch black, overcast. We came out of the caves and never knew it. We're out, Jizz. We made it."
They leaped to their feet, peering, listening, sniffing. The night was impenetrable, but they heard the soft sigh of night winds, and the sweet scent of green growing things came to their nostrils. Far in the distance, a dog barked.
"My God, Cully,"
Gisbella whispered incredulously.
"You're right. We're out of Gouffre Martel. All we have to do is wait for dawn."
She laughed. She flung her arms about him and kissed him, and he returned the embrace. They babbled excitedly. They sank down onto the soft grass again, weary, but unable to rest, eager, impatient, all life before them.
"Hello, Gully, darling Gully. Hello, Gully, after all this time."
"Hello, Jess."
"I told you we'd meet someday soon. I told you, darling. And this is the day."
"The night."
"The night, so it is. But no more murmuring in the night along the whisper line. No more night for us, Gully dear."
Suddenly they became aware that they were nude, lying close, no longer separated. Gisbella fell silent, but did not move. He clasped her almost angrily, and enveloped her with a desire that was no less than hers. When dawn came, he saw that she was lovely, long and lean, with smoky red hair and a generous mouth. But when dawn came, she saw his face. Chapter 6. Harley Baker, M.D., had a small general practice in Montana, Oregon, which was legitimate, and barely paid for the diesel oil he consumed each weekend, participating in the rallies for vintage tractors, which were the vogue in Sahara. His real income was earned in his freak factory in Trenton, to which Baker jaunted every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night. There, for enormous fees and no questions asked, Baker created monstrosities for the entertainment business and refashioned skin, muscle and bone for the underworld. Looking like a male midwife,